According to our next guest, the question facing us is whether we are prepared to do what is necessary to save our democracy. The book, The Bill of Obligations, 10 Habits of Good Citizens, is a call for change. New York Times bestselling author Richard Haass argues that the very idea of citizenship must be revised and expanded. The Bill of Rights is at the center of our Constitution, yet our most intractable conflicts often emerge from contrasting views as to what our rights ought to be. According to Haass, there is a cure to place obligations on the same footing as rights. The 10 obligations that he introduces are essential for healing our divisions and safeguarding the country's future. Dr. Richard Haass is president of the Nonpartisan Council on Foreign Relations, an experienced diplomat and policymaker. He served in the Pentagon, State Department, and White House under four presidents, Democrat and Republican alike. He will be at Tent in Amenia, New York, not this Saturday, but next Saturday, February 11th, from 3 to 6, talking about and signing the book, which will be provided by Oblong Books, and we'll give you some information. You can go to oblongbooks.com to find out about the event, and we'll give you some information on how to RSVP for that event later on in the segment. In the meantime, we welcome Richard Haass to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this particular list of obligations?
It wasn't by some plan or design. I mean, the whole book I was brought to almost accidentally. It was one of those that I didn't set out to do it so much as I realized that my thinking had brought me to the point that the biggest challenges we faced were internal. And then the more I thought about it, talked to people, read about it, and so forth, I came up with various obligations and then further talked to people about it and went back in American history. And let me just sort of say, these are my 10. I expect others will have some of their own, which is great. I would love to have a conversation about other things we might consider introducing or doing more of in order to bolster American democracy. That's the end we all want. This is just my suggested. I like the number 10, good round number, a little bit of a parallels to some other things, and obviously the Bill of Rights, which is where the title is derived from.
Right.
But I'm I basically came to it by reading, thinking, and talking.
What is it that got us here to this point where these problems did become internalized?
It's a good question. I think it's a number of things. It's everything from one thing we don't do terribly well, which is we don't teach our story in schools increasingly. You can graduate from almost any college or university in this country, and while civics courses are offered, they're not required. I think that we took our democracy for granted, even though when it was created, we had 3 million people, and now we have over 330 million people, and we assume that a lot of things would continue to work. We face all sorts of social and economic problems in this country. And in recent decades in particular, economic circumstances for many Americans haven't improved, which made them much more questioning of the value of government. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan similarly increased skepticism of elites. I think also the changing media landscape had a big role. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. That was the era of broadcasting. Well, now we live in the era of narrowcasting, whether it's cable or radio, obviously all the various social media outlets. So fewer and fewer Americans have common experiences. I could go on. There's the weakening of political parties. There's new changes in how we fund our politics. It's a long list of explanations of how we got to where we are. And the lesson I take from that is it won't be easy or a simple or single thing to turn it around. I don't think there's any quick single fix out there for American democracy either.
I know this is a simple question, but I'm curious as to how it fits into the narrative of where the book came from. But what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of a look to overturn a free and fair election, this obviously brings us to a point that is unbelievable, right? I mean, that is something that we should look at and say we really need to do something.
Absolutely. If 3 or 4 years ago we had been having this conversation and you had raised that possibility, I probably wouldn't have taken it all that seriously. Now I do. And now I actually say what happened on January 6th ought to be something of a wake-up call. I don't assume it was a one-off. I spent 3 years as the U.S. envoy to Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland went through 3 decades from the 60s to the 90s of what were called the Troubles. And that was politically inspired violence, decentralized, and so forth. I can imagine that a version of that happening here at state houses, at city halls, assassinations, bombings. I don't think it's inconceivable in this country. So I take our challenges seriously, and we ought not to dismiss January 6th. I mean, we didn't dismiss 9/11, and we for better and for worse, we responded to it with big changes to our foreign policy. I would say we ought not to allow something like January 6th to happen without taking it seriously and thinking about what we have to do to make sure that nothing like it ever happens again.
You say that what is more, the threat to American democracy is not limited to those who stormed the Capitol or the elected officials who cheered them on. An equally serious threat stems from the slow but steady erosion of popular support for democracy's underpinnings. Is that what got us to January 6th?
In part, you don't want to create a democracy where only those who feel the most strongly get involved, because often that very strength of conviction will be illiberal in the sense of intolerant and even at times a willingness to justify any means by the ends, which are viewed as somehow deserving. So I think the passivity or non-involvement of a lot of Americans is a worrisome thing. Look, we just had critical midterm elections in this country. Obviously, a lot was at stake. What's so interesting is more than half of the eligible voters didn't vote in the midterm elections. So why is that? And what is it we have to do? And it wasn't only because in some cases it's difficult to vote. A lot of people, for whatever set of reasons, didn't bother to vote, didn't think their vote mattered, didn't feel they had time, didn't get up to speed on the issues or the candidates, or didn't see any differences. Long list of explanations. But the fact is, if people do not get involved in politics, they're essentially leaving the political future of this country, which will affect them, to others who may have agendas that they don't share.
To that point, you bring this up several times in the book, if American democracy is to survive, ... And then you go through many reasons. If it is to survive, we must do this or this must happen. But what is it about the people who don't vote? What is it about the people who don't get involved? What is it about the people who look at what happened even on January 6th and say, well, that will never happen again, but even if it does, we survived it the first time, we'll survive it again?
Well, I think you characterize it pretty well. Look, people are busy. I understand. You know, we've all got jobs or economic concerns. We've got personal health concerns. We've got family issues. We got things we want to do with our spare time. So I don't expect most Americans to get up every morning and say, oh, good, I can spend another day devoting all my time and energy to politics. People have lives they want to lead. But my point is simply that democracy in this country or anywhere is not a permanent given. It's not necessarily the natural order of things. One of the reasons I think we need to do a better job of teaching it is I want people to understand that this is a valuable inheritance, this thing called American democracy. And we ought not to either take it for granted, much less see it be dismantled. It's one of the reasons that I would argue that teaching civics in our schools, middle schools, high schools, colleges, is so essential.
As you said, our list may vary, but these are, as you say, obligations. Give us a sense of how we should feel that we're obligated to do these things, and why for some people that's a difficult task.
Well, obligations are things we should do or ought to do. They're not things that you can be forced to do or legally required to do. So there's elements of choice. And sometimes it involves difficult things, or it means giving up some of our preferences. It might mean thinking long term rather than immediate. It's easier to focus on what's coming to us, what's good for us, our rights, what's quote unquote owed us, rather than things we might owe others. And often it's sometimes hard to see the connection. Now, I ought to compromise here, even if it goes against some of my own preferences, because tomorrow I may need to work with this person on another issue, or it's worth preserving this institution, even if I don't get all of what I want. It's not easy. You know, again, the whole process of compromise, of democratic deliberation is not easy. Getting up to speed on these issues, getting informed takes time, going out to vote takes time. So, you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. It's not an easy sport for people to get involved in. It's quite demanding. And so it doesn't surprise me that a lot of people basically say it's too hard or I'm going to leave it to others.
Richard Haass is the author of The Bill of Obligations. He will be at Tent in Amenia, New York on Saturday, February 11th at 3 p.m. to sign and talk about the Book of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. The book is on the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list. That congratulations, first of all. But second, it does tell us that many of us must want to change, right? That we feel that we need to do something.
Yeah, thank you. And I think so. When I talk about this book, over the last couple of years when I was thinking about it and writing it, now that I put it out, it does resonate. And that's not me bragging about me, but it tells you something about the subject. And I think it tells you that many Americans know things aren't quite right. People know there's something wrong. When I talk about the need to teach civics or have more national service, about having politicians who put country first rather than their own careers first, I get a lot of nodding heads. And I believe that a lot of Americans know that things have gone off the rails in this country. So I think it resonates because there's a widespread recognition that things have gone somewhat wrong. And the real challenge, I think, not just for me, but for all of us, is to then say, okay, if we begin with that recognition that things have gone off the rails, can we build a consensus at least in favor of some things to do? Some of the things I write about, potentially some other things, and that's what I'm hoping. But I do think this taps into a recognition that all is not right or all is not what it should be.
The 10 Habits of Good Citizens is the subtitle of the book. The Bill of Obligations that you write about: be informed, get involved, stay open to compromise, remain civil, reject violence, value norms, promote the common good, respect government service, support the teaching of civics, and put country first. It seems to me all of those are important, and all of those obviously go to your point. The one that both that seemed to be so difficult lately are remaining civil, one, but more importantly, this idea of staying open to compromise. It seems as though a day does not go by where we do not have at least 20 concrete examples of that idea of, that there is room for compromise, there's an opportunity for compromise, but instead there is no compromise.
You're right. It's ironic, given that the Constitution that provides the foundation for this entire conversation was itself a product of compromise, of multiple compromises. And you look at American history, and one of the reasons we've not only survived for 240-odd years, but we've thrived is because of a willingness to compromise at critical moments in American history. I think it has gotten harder. That's where the changing media landscape has changed, that It's easier for individual sites or constituencies to attack a politician. The way we fund our politics, the weakening of parties. Parties used to be compromising mechanisms. Well, now individuals can get money or from political action committees and the rest, or organizations that impose compromise. And that's the way it works. So I think compromise has gotten more difficult. It's become something of a dirty word. People often hear the word compromise, and they associate it with being unprincipled. It's interesting, when John F. Kennedy wrote the book, Profiles in Courage, half of the cases he wrote about, half the senators he wrote about, were people who were willing to compromise in contexts or moments when compromise was controversial. So compromise can often be the most principled thing to do. It can be a way of putting country first. We're going to have an interesting test of it, by the way, in a couple of months, this whole issue of the debt ceiling.
Yes.
And I think it'll be an interesting test case, because a refusal to pass the debt ceiling, I think, would be calamitous in terms of its economic consequences for this country. And so I think it'll be an interesting moment for, and particularly for the Republicans, who have staked out this position of opposition to compromise, whether they are prepared to put country first. We can have, and we should have, big debates over levels of spending, over priorities for spending, over taxation. Those are all totally legitimate and necessary areas of political debate. They should not be tied up, though, with the debt ceiling, which is simply a mechanism for paying for past spending and taxation decisions. So it'll be very interesting to see whether the Republicans, who have somewhat painted themselves into a corner, whether they can figure out a way to get out of that corner, and whether the administration, in turn, lends that, at least extends its hand somewhat in order to provide a context for compromise that would serve the country. You don't want the country to pay a price and have it simply pinned on one political party if all Americans would pay a price for it.
So of looking at paying that price, I mean, that's something that everyone needs to do. I'm curious as to why it is that even in this, in when we're talking about things like the debt ceiling, of that, well, look, the easiest way to put this is, why is there so much hypocrisy? Why is what they say when the Democrats are in charge is much different than when they're in charge? I mean, what does that say about it, and how do you change that?
Well, it's cynical. It's putting party before country. I think the only way you can change that is when voters understand what's going on and penalize certain behaviors and reward others. So I think the media has an opportunity, but also an obligation here, the challenge to explain this issue as best they can. It's not simple. Educators have the same thing. Individual citizens have a certain obligation, again, to get informed. That's the only way this is going to work. It's easy to caricature this, and it's easy to be cynical about this. But as you say, Republicans acted differently on this issue when you had a Republican president. So, you know, we'll see what happens. And by the way, I'm not partisan. I spent most of my life as a Republican, even though I'm critical of many of the things I see going on now. But I think this will be a revealing moment, shall we say, in American politics, how this plays out.
Okay, my turn to be cynical. So how do we how do we determine the best way to teach civics, to support the teaching of civics and how we're going to teach civics, when you see we can't figure out how to teach African-American history?
Look, you're right, and it is borderline crazy, I think, is the expression I use, that we teach civics differently in each of the 50 states. Either we don't teach them in some states, or the content of the curriculum is different, because the whole idea is to create a national identity and a common national fabric. And the idea that it's taught differently in different states or cities is contrary to the purpose. That said, there's zero chance at the moment you could get consensus on a national civics curriculum, I would think. I think the best way is going to be, you're going to start it in various states. Justice Brandeis years ago talked about states being the laboratories of democracy. And I think you're going to have different states coming up with their own approach. And what I'm hoping is, over time, the certain approaches gain traction and gain popularity, and more states come to them. It's an imperfect answer, and you're right to be skeptical or even cynical, because education now is at a minimum politicized, and worse yet, is getting weaponized. So I'm not going to sit here and be naive and say this is easy. This is tough, but I just simply say it's important also.
Skepticism aside, what is the level of your optimism that we can meet these obligations?
So I have some optimism. I'm concerned, but I'm not defeatist in any ways. I think there's a decent chance we'll get growing support for national service. I think you'd even see some bipartisan support for that. I think there is increased interest in civics. So, as you just pointed out, the politicization of it is going to make it more difficult. I'm hoping there's a bit of a pulling back. I'm not sure about violence after January 6th and the fact that so many people have paid a price legally for it, and hopefully in some cases politically might discourage more of it. But look, I have no illusions. If this were easy, I wouldn't have bothered writing it. It wasn't easy to write the book. Never easy to write a book. But I just think it's important. And it's going to take time, and there's not going to be a single solution. It's not going to come from the top down. It's going to mean some religious authorities doing what they're meant to do and preach good behaviors. It's going to mean some schools and taking on certain missions, some businesses who are willing to speak out on this or that social issue. Why aren't businesses willing to do more to speak out for democracy? Mm. They depend on the rule of law. So what I'm hoping is I can get a bit of a conversation going in this country and maybe mobilize some individuals or some entities to basically see it in their own self-interest to do this. I don't expect to change human nature here. What I'm hoping is that more people and organizations will see this as not only the right thing to do, but the smart thing to do.
Richard Haass, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Again, you can find out more information about his event on February 11th at oblongbooks.com.